This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When forests are logged or burned, carbon floods into the atmosphere, as you might imagine, but that is not the end of it. The loss continues for decades as a significant factor in climate change. In fact, a new paper from a young Australian scientist says experts and planners underestimate the true costs of hacking into tropical rainforests by a stunning 626%. That means the damage to the atmosphere is six times greater than previously thought. The new paper in the prestigious journal Nature was published October 30, 2019. We reached the lead author, Dr. Sean L. Maxwell, at the University of Queensland in Australia, but right now he's in Vienna, Austria. And Sean published important work while still an undergraduate, holds a diploma in yoga education from India, and speaks passably the Indonesian language of Bahasa. From Vienna, Sean Maxwell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex. Great to be talking with you. This most recent paper is not in Nature, but in Science Advances. It is a Nature journal, but it's the sister journal to Nature.
Okay. I suspect you're more than a scientist. Are you also a passionate conservation activist?
It's hard. I spend so much time in the office, so it's hard to really believe in myself when I say I'm an activist as well. I certainly have seen the activities that have been all the marches in the street that are happening around the world, particularly by young folks, and very inspired by that. But certainly the majority of my time I'm spending in the office trying to push forward the science.
And you bounced into public view with your 2016 article, Guns, Nets, and Bulldozers Driving Species Loss. You argued climate change isn't killing species. We do most of it the old-fashioned way. Is that correct?
That's what the current numbers say, that the greatest number of species are in fact threatened by hunting and over-harvesting and also logging and unsustainable use of natural resources generally. An important caveat to that study was that a lot of current assessments aren't able to truly capture the impact of climate change and what that'll have in the future. So we expect in the next few decades that climate change will become a more prevalent factor for biodiversity generally, but certainly at the moment, in the near term, next 10 to 20 years, deforestation, hunting are still the biggest drivers of biodiversity decline globally.
I'm not going to lie to you. Trying to sell tropical forests must be saved isn't as easy these days. Perhaps issue fatigue has set in, but now your team shows intact forest loss is a critical factor for whether we win or lose the climate fight. Sean, talk to us about the old and the new vision of tropical forests vis-a-vis climate.
Sure. Yeah, well, I think you're quite right there that, you know, the global community, policymakers, scientists have for a long time now talked about the importance of forests generally, tropical forests in particular, not just for climate, and that is an important issue, but for other big factors as well, such as natural disaster mitigation, given that they prevent things like landslides and flooding events. In certain cases, they're also able to increase local amounts of rainfall. And, you know, and most importantly, from an ecologist's perspective, is they maintain their strongholds for large amounts of biodiversity as well. So, yeah, despite all that messaging that's been happening for a long time, still not quite seeing enough funding and action towards the conservation of tropical forests in particular. From the carbon point of view, we think that's maybe because conventionally we just only look at emissions, amount of carbon emitted from just the clearance of forests. So that is a switch from at a site, a forested area, to a completely non-forested area. So that is to this day still a major factor when we look at emissions globally. But increasingly, there's more studies coming out that show that degradation of forests are actually playing a big role as well, and that once you clear a forest, you create essentially new forest edges. And these new forest edges, the conditions in those edges are different to what they were before the clearance event happened. Those conditions are often drier, they're often windier, and the drying and the wind brings with it more tree mortality, so that can be a source of emissions. And we're starting to get a bit of an idea of what that means in the whole scheme of things, the global climate. But importantly as well, once you clear a forest, you open it up to other activities such as logging and more hunting of these around these forests. So logging is important because you obviously selectively take out trees. And in most cases, those trees are either ground up or burnt, and there's an emission associated with that. The hunting element has carbon factor as well, in that hunting often targets the species that do a great job of spreading seeds around the landscape and helping forests to regenerate. So once you've lost that regeneration factor, the ability for forests to actually store carbon and sequester carbon goes down as well. So whilst it takes a while to describe these things, and maybe I'm straining the attention of your listeners just getting through it all, but we know these factors are also important from the carbon story of forests. So the new age is starting to get at those elements and how we can better fund the retention of these important elements.
Now, supposing I had $10,000 in the bank, I mean, a man can dream, and I'm getting interest on it. Now, I take that $10,000 out and I lose it all at the casino. It's not just that I lost the $10,000. I've also lost all the interest I would have got on it for the next 10 or the rest of my life. And that, I think you put under the label of foregone carbon sequestration. Could you talk to us about what that means and why it matters?
Wow, what a fantastic analogy. I wish we had thought about that. That's a great way to describe what we think is a major advance that this paper we've published recently provides. So what you're talking about there is essentially what carbon forests could have sequestered had they remained intact. So what we actually, we put a measure on that. We say if the intact forest areas that we're looking at, had they remained intact between the years 2000 and 2050, we know that they would have sequestered around a gigaton of carbon. And conventional ways of looking at the carbon impact of losing forests don't actually capture that very well at all. So we could refer to that as a foregone removal or foregone earning, if you like, of carbon. And whilst this study, our study, only looked at a small subset of forests globally, just those intact forests, the ones with very little human activities inside them, and parcels of intact forests that became non-intact recently. So we're only really looking at 50 million hectares of forest here. There's 500 million hectares of these intact forests remaining globally that we can apply this metric to, that we can better capture or account for their carbon impact if we conserve them properly.
How do you find out how much intact tropical forest there is?
There's quite a few different measures, different ways of cutting it. One measure is to look at land use change right back in time. So people much more clever than me have generated maps of how humans have changed land use, but even back to the year 1500, and projected that forward to essentially now, and any areas that were forested that we know are suitable for forested areas that haven't had noticeable and permanent amounts of land use change on them, so a switch from a forest to a grazing area, or a switch from a grazing area to a cropping area, or even a switch to an urban landscape, we can track these things through time, and essentially by a process of elimination, any areas that were not changed and are forested, we can refer to them as primary forests or intact forests. Another way, and perhaps a more up-to-date way, is to just look at the moment where, using satellites, where is the major human activities on Earth? Things like roads and buildings and agriculture. If we combine all those things, we can then, again, process of elimination, look at where those things are not, and we can refer to those or start to identify where the intact forests are.
Another little detail in your paper that really caught my eye was defaunation, and you talk about how a change in the animals in the forest can change the forest itself, and even that has a carbon effect. How does that work?
Yeah, again, this is an emerging science, really. We know that as forests become more accessible, as roads cut through forests, they're more likely to have hunting pressure inside them. And this is not sort of traditional subsistence hunting. This is typically hunting with quite modern instruments that we're looking at. and hunting that could be used to generate products for market or for export. So, and know that hunting pressure typically targets the species or the animals, be that a hornbill in Southeast Asia or an elephant in Central Africa, these animals that are really important for spreading seeds of big carbon trees that soak up a lot of carbon. They rely on these animals to regenerate, to spread their seeds and to actually ensure that the next generation of big trees is planted. So once you lose those animals, that we're now getting an idea of just what that means in terms of the carbon stored in a forest and its ability to sequester carbon in the future.
In 2018, you led another paper with seven co-authors, Conservation Implications of Ecological Responses to Extreme Weather and Climate Events. I kind of liked your working title better. I think I found it online. Global conservation priorities are ignorant to the extreme. So anyway, what's the scoop with extreme weather and conservation planning?
Yeah, I must apologize there. Sometimes when us scientists were trying to be as accurate as possible, we lose touch with what makes sense, I guess. But yes, that study was just looking at events that, I guess, are abnormal in terms of their magnitude or in terms of their frequency, I guess. You know, you mentioned that things are quite dry in your area of the world. I guess that that's historically as a precedent, but a lot of the areas that are known to be dry are becoming drier. So there's less rainfall and the rainfall's less often. So those sort of factors can help us decide when an event, a weather event, is actually extreme or whether it's just a kind of slight diversion from a historical baseline.
Yeah, here in Canada, we make some pretty big national parks and often trying to protect special animals or plant communities. And then it gets hotter, the fire rages over the protected area, or the water supplies go haywire. We almost need movable parks these days. What can we do?
Well, that's quite a forward-thinking idea. And one that still generates a lot of, well, not still, it's, there's a paper back in 2010 written by some folks at the University of Queensland that proposed removing protected areas that are not effective and replacing them with ones that could maybe do more for biodiversity. But that was met with quite a bit of criticism, despite it being, you know, theoretically a quite defensible and maybe a smart move. So one of the pillars of protected areas are that they are permanent. So we're very reluctant, I guess, to propose moving them or making them in any way not permanent. But in many cases, just like you're saying, we need to change them, and that could benefit the actual objective of protected areas, which is actually to conserve, you know, the plants and animals on this earth. It could benefit from more dynamic planning, more adaptive planning, I guess. But getting the legislating that and making sure that flexibility is not abused by nations is something that we're still sort of grappling with as a scientific community.
And reading your new paper, I got bushwhacked by the simple phrase, all tropical forests outside protected areas are expected to be logged. It's all going to be logged? How far along are we with that?
Yeah, well, that's the statement. And again, it's not completely in agreement, but you know, in science, that's one of the that's one of the nice sides. You can never have to look too far to find a debate. But certainly, there's a lot of evidence that most forests have already managed, and that they indeed will be logged again by the year 2050. So we are getting better at mapping where logging is occurring. So it's quite difficult to map where it is using satellites, because it's harder to detect using satellites, because often in the tropics, at least, logging is not a clear felling of a patch, but just a thinning of a large area. A removal of the largest trees. But the way satellites are heading, the way smart people are analysing those satellite images, we're not too far away from being able to say this area was logged in this year. So then we'll get a better understanding of just the extent of logging and hopefully be better able to incentivise logging in certain areas where it's not going to affect, or it's going to have less impact on biodiversity persistence. making sure that it doesn't occur in the old growth, highly carbon dense forests that are so important for biodiversity and the climate.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. My guest is Dr. Sean Maxwell from the University of Queensland. We are talking about how disappearing tropical forests can damage the climate for all of us. And you write about the big contribution protecting intact tropical forests can play, helping countries reach their commitments for the Paris Climate Agreement. But what do you mean? I mean, do places like the Congo, that is heavily forested, we hope, somehow need forest credits to meet their emission rights?
Certainly. I mean, again, our study focused on those intact systems. So whilst there's a lot of, relatively, there is some funding for preventing deforestation, especially in tropical countries that are developing, a lot of that money is targeted at the deforestation frontier, they say, which is just those areas in countries where deforestation rates were quite high in recent years. So while that's important to prevent, there's almost no funding going towards the countries or the areas that are doing a really good job of looking after old growth, intact forests. So what our study does is just reveal just how important these areas are for the climate, and just how much the countries and the local communities, just how important it is that these people and countries continue to conserve them, the intact forests in particular, and they need more support to do that, essentially. More funding, more attention, more of a social license as well. It's very tempting to, instead of conserving these intact forests, receive one-off or partial financial payments to clear it and to convert it for other uses.
So is there a working mechanism where polluting nations like Germany or China can gain climate credits by protecting intact tropical forests somewhere else?
Yeah, there sure is. Yeah, sure is, Alex. There's an existing framework called, collectively referred to as Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation, or it's also called REDD+. So that's the acronym. And that does already have guidelines that permit or that reward, incentivize the retention of intact forests. It's just the way in which people are accounting for that retention, that accounting for the climate benefits of that retention of intact forests in particular, that's not quite accurate. It's not really representative of how important it is, and therefore efforts that conserve intact forests are not rewarded as much as efforts that look at the deforestation frontier, those areas that are under immediate threat and have large amounts of loss in the recent past.
So do citizens of already industrialized countries, sitting comfortably at home, looking at wildlife videos on YouTube, do they have any right to advise or demand forest conservation action from tropical countries where millions of people are unemployed or live in poverty?
Well, I think certainly demand is the wrong approach, and will be met with either silence if those people in tropical developing countries are polite, but could equally and quite rightly be met with frustration. I think a more productive and reasonable and appropriate way is to just support those nations. So be that by just sharing the message, talking with people about how there's a continuum of forest quality, and at the moment we're just looking at those forests that are right at the edge of where humans are expanding their footprint, to those really, really high quality, intact, and in some places remote forests that people in many cases are still living in and actually maintaining these forested areas. So and so just recognising that initially, there's a continuum of quality within forests, and we need to fund forest conservation in ways that make sure we do still capture the best quality forests and ensure that any development that doesn't occur just doesn't sweep right through the centre of the heart of the most high quality, most important forests that we have left. So supporting nations, you know, either at the voting booth or through donations to groups, people in countries that are not tropical, that are developed, can support nations in that way, rather than just demanding that these countries do what's good for the planet, without being properly rewarded or recognized for that.
Now, as we speak, Indonesia is transforming some of the last primitive rainforests into palm oil plantations or fiber for high fashion clothes like nylon. Sean Maxwell, what is your assessment of the fate of Indonesia's forests?
Well, yeah, Alex, it's I don't want to be too negative here, but every time we look at this, we see Indonesia as critically important for biodiversity, one of the most biodiverse places on Earth, some of the most carbon-dense forests on Earth, but also a place where we've got population, high population density, proposals to move whole capital cities to highly forested nations. So I'm sure many of your listeners know that this proposal to move the capital city from Jakarta to Kalimantan, so the island of Kalimantan, which at the moment is one of the last homes for orangutans globally. So whilst the proposal to do that, they recognise that they need to have an eco-friendly capital city, and you know we should commend them for that. Whether it will actually be eco-friendly and what that means, I'm sure we'll find out. But yeah, it's very concerning, and people need to change their individual behaviours beyond just advocating and supporting the countries, the people that are at the front line for forest conservation. The actions that individual people do take really do make a difference. So reducing your consumption is critical and very important. Don't ever dismiss that, the importance of that. And also other things broadly around population change as well. Whilst it's, I view it as unethical to really force people to, of course, have either a certain number of children or none at all. That's unethical and that's something you never advocate for. But recognising that empowering women and giving women in developing nations in particular opportunities to have a good education and to be self-empowered are really important and keys to reducing population growth rates, which are driving these pressures on intact forests globally.
So it seems to me that you're not just a lone wolf in the way you operate. You try to bring people together for some common cause, whether it's landowners or government types or scientists. Why is that important to you, Sean?
I just think it's the only way forward. It is when we get into a cycle of just pursuing personal agendas or even agendas of research groups or governments without recognising, without integrating other views and other perspectives. That's, we know from history that that is leads to either major crashes or in human quality of life or in certainly in terms of environmental condition. And also that it just perpetuates this cycle of not learning from our mistakes in the past.
You know, we have some listeners on college radio stations, and I think some of them are asking themselves, is there still time, is it still worthwhile to go through academia and maybe study for your doctorate while the world is heading into a climate emergency? What are your thoughts on that?
I can certainly understand people that have those thoughts, and you're not alone, first of all. To get through it in the short term, just lean on each other, find groups of people that you can discuss these sorts of things in ways that help you be critical but also progress through issues. But you should also know that there is change coming. So by 2050, hopefully, we would have sorted out sustainable consumption patterns, sustainable population growth, these major factors that are driving ecological damage around the world. There's big international agendas that are set out to do just that, resolve those issues. Once we get those things right, the landscape and the seascape for biodiversity will change. And then the question will be, instead of how do we best retain the last of the best or biodiversity generally, how can we actually regenerate those species that have been lost in the past or those ecosystems that have been lost in the past. There's still going to be lots of questions that need to be answered in the future by very smart people. So certainly still pursue it if you're passionate about it, because there's lots to be done.
Is it your sense that there is support now among more Australians for climate action, or is it still a tug of war between the jobs and coal crowd and the Greens?
It's a tough one to gauge. Whilst there is that division between the jobs and coal, and the Greens. I think it's fair to say that the jobs element is really under question by the majority of Australians now. There's just too many studies coming out that showing that continuing to pursue down an avenue of coal exports and a one-dimensional economy generally around exporting coal and natural resources is going to be a liability for Australia's economy in the future. We need to diversify jobs, we need to diversify skill sets in Australia, or be left behind. So whilst the coal community are doing all they can to sort of prevent climate change, the government in particular and people need to support more conscious effort, more meaningful effort towards Australia's contribution to climate change. And again, within the divisions, I think... And it's present around the world, young versus old, if I might say. Whilst the younger generation recognise that what we've done to the climate in the past will especially impact them, they want action on climate change. They want Australia in particular to play their role, just like we have in past major events. Despite not having a per capita contribution to certain things, we've always wanted and taken great pride in doing more than is actually on paper required of us. So we want to play that role. We can play that role. We're developed, a rich country, and the world needs us to do that. So time will tell whether we do or not, but it certainly has my support and the support of many other people in Australia.
Yeah, we need you to help us by cutting back the coal production and exports, but the people of Australia need the rest of the world so that, well, frankly, the parts of the country don't burn down every year, as is currently happening, and to get past the drought, perhaps, and all sorts of problems that global climate change is going to bring back to Australia. So as we wrap up here, Sean, how can people follow your work?
Well, a few different ways. We've got a website called greenfirescience.com. Their contact details are on there, so get along to the website and you can find our contact details there, keep in touch with all the latest. The University of Queensland School of Earth and Environmental Sciences website is also a good resource to track and look out for opportunities, say, if anyone out there would like to come and do a bit of research in the lab or at least get a feel for what it's like. We're always looking for passionate and keen students to help us out, and just personally as well. You can contact me in different ways. I'm sure maybe on the online version of this presentation, this interview, I'll happily put my email address alongside it if that helps.
I'll tack that right in my blog at ecoshock.org. We've been speaking with Dr. Sean L. Maxwell. His latest publication just out at the end of October is Degradation and Foregone Removals Increase the Carbon Impact of Intact Forest Loss by 626%. Sean, good to meet you, and keep the scientific information coming. We need it.
Oh, thanks so much, Alex, for your attention to this and for comprehending it all as well. Fantastic job.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.